From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with humorist P.J. O'Rourke. A former editor of the National Lampoon, these days O'Rourke is, among other things, investigative humorist for Rolling Stone. Also today, I'll talk with Academy Award-winning production designer Patrizia von Brandenstein. It's her work that gives movies such as The Untouchables and Amadeus their period realism. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review tuner recordings by conductor Pierre Boulez. And our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on a new Broadway production of Pygmalion and its views of social class and diction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is writer P.J. O'Rourke. He's a self-described Republican humorist, and he thinks that most people regard that as a contradiction in terms. As investigative humorist for Rolling Stone magazine, O'Rourke has written about topics such as a peace cruise up the Volga River with aging American leftists, his conversations with prostitutes and rioters during the presidential elections in Manila. He's parodied Manhattan's downtown scene, media vanity, and his own Republican inclinations. These pieces are collected in his new book, Republican Party Reptile. O'Rourke has another new book titled The Bachelor Home Companion, a practical guide to keeping house like a pig. He argues that Camus had it all wrong about the myth of Sisyphus. It's not symbolic of life. It's about housekeeping. P.J. O'Rourke was editor of the National Lampoon in the late 70s. Since then, he's written for many, many magazines. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you to explain the concept of Republican Party Reptile.
Well, I think one of the things there is that, although I do consider myself a Republican, I'm probably at heart more of a sort of conservative libertarian, but that saying that you're a libertarian party animal, libertarian is one of those words that sounds like they're already running around in nothing but a sheet and carrying a bunch of grapes. There's a little bit of marketing involved in that, trying to get that oxymoron in there, you know.
This is kind of like the lounge lizard of the political set.
Right, exactly. And get the reader to think of sort of a festive, naked Everett Dirksen.
So what are the characteristics of you as the Republican Party reptile?
Basically, I think what it is someone who wants who distrusts government interference in personal life, in life period. I mean, who is conservative to the extent that he believes that the role of the federal government should be to guard the coasts and tote the mail, and that they should stay the heck out of stuff they don't understand, which is practically everything. But who also, unlike conventional conservatives, doesn't feel that the government has to also go, on the contrary, to sort of butting in on school prayer issues and telling people who they can kiss and what part of who they can kiss and whether you can smoke marijuana in your own bathroom with a wet towel under the door so the kids won't smell it, you know, or not.
Let's emphasize here that in your time you've been into heavy drinking, heavy
yes.
drugs.
Last night was heavy drinking.
Driving fast, speeding cars, mm-hmm. Crazy things. And I bet a lot of conservatives are sorry that you've joined their side.
I hope so. I only hope so. But, you know, what's strange is I think that there are a lot of people. I say this in my introduction to my book. I said that there are a tremendous number of people who feel like I do in the United States, especially after three or four drinks, you know, where it's sort of a smash Iran and get the government to leave me alone. Lower taxes and smash Iran. But I really think I've gotten a very good response to this book from a lot of the legislative aides, Republican legislative aides, the younger conservatives in Washington, who have very conservative political principles, but who really don't believe in this kind of Jerry Falwell sort of conservatism, for whom that is repellent, as it is for me.
You've described Republican humorist as an oxymoron. A
yeah, there are a couple, in but terms. Not many.
Why do you think that's so? I mean, is that so? And if so, why is that so?
I don't really think it's so, but I think it's part of the public persona of conservatism in the United States is that it's older, more dignified sort of sensibility, not your sort of fool around, joke around, kid around. You're not going to see a Hamilton Jordan in a Republican White House. But I think it has generally to do with the sort of general pomposity of American politics. It's not like the Democrats are a big bowl of fun either, for that matter. You know, they just get caught more often.
Do you think there's a difference between liberal and conservative humor?
Yes, there very definitely is. One of the things that I think conservatives and humorists, I really don't think liberals have a very good sense of humor. And one of the reasons for that is the liberals fundamentally believe that human beings are good and conservatives do not. This is probably the real basis of the difference between conservatism and liberalism. And I certainly fall on the believing humans to be pretty bad scale of sort of things. Now, you see, a conservative will say to you, you shouldn't make fun of cripples. You shouldn't make fun of the handicapped, they will say to you. And they may very well be right about that. But a liberal will say, you can't make fun of handicap. You can't do that. You can't. Well, anybody who's heard the joke about Helen Keller falling down a manhole and breaking six fingers calling for help knows that you can make fun of the handicap. Whether you should or not is an entirely different question, but you can make fun of the handicap. And no conservative would pretend that you couldn't. They will simply say you oughtn't to. And indeed, really, you oughtn't to. I think that liberals want a joke, any sort of joke, to have a point. They want it to be Mort Sahl up there. When you get done with his routine, you want to go out there and integrate a lunch counter. Conservatives know, I think, that the humor is many things. It's primarily its sublimated aggression, and it is by no means good. Laughter is involuntary. Rhetorical points are not. You can use humor to make rhetorical points, but that's only one of its many uses.
Was becoming a conservative a shift for you? Did you start your early adulthood as a liberal?
No. I was born in my early adulthood, yes, but I was born and raised a very rock-ribbed Republican household. And when I was in college, of course, I did the obligatory flip-flop where I became sort of a flaming idiot, motor-mouthed Maoist, whatever. I went through the sort of, in fact, I sometimes refer to myself on the college lecture circuit as reformed pinko beatnik. I went through that thing that many of us did in the 60s of being. But always, I think there was an undercurrent of an opposition to authority, which I still feel very strongly. And as I got older, all during the 70s, I started to move politically to the right. But my fundamental attitude about authority has always been the same. I didn't like it when I was a kid. I didn't like it when I was in college, and I don't like it now. I think the state should be allowed to exercise the minimal possible amount of authority over us.
When you went from the left to the right, did you leave a lot of friends behind? Did your friends, your circle of friends, change with your
politics? I would say it was about half and half of the group of people that I knew in the late 60s and early 70s, many of whom I still know. About half of them have made the same sort of shift that I have, and about half of them remain wedded to one degree or another, usually emotionally, to that wonderful 60s period. And the 60s period was wonderful. It was a lot of fun. But as John Lennon pointed out, and is quoted in the current issue of People magazine, where I get all of my deep intellectual insights, is that the 60s were first and foremost a great way to meet girls. You know, I mean, that was... that we were, first and foremost, we were having fun in the 60s. Only secondarily were we having any serious political thoughts. We were having a good time.
Writer and humorist P.J. O'Rourke is my guest. He's a former editor of the National Lampoon and currently goes by the title of investigative humorist for Rolling Stone magazine. He has two new books out, including a collection of his pieces called Republican Party Reptile. Now, you used to edit the National Lampoon in the late 70s. How do you think it had changed under your editorial control from what it had been before?
Well, when I took it over at the end of 1977, I tried to bring in some of that shift to the right. The Lampoon had actual political lines, always been sort of classically liberal, not leftist by any means. It was often thought of as being anarchistic or very left-wing, which it wasn't. It was pretty much a classic liberal. And that was appropriate, I think, during the Nixon years. But it wasn't only me. It was also a person who was very influential in the Lampoon during the 3 years that I edited it was John Hughes, who now makes the teenage movies. In fact, Hughes and I, this title, Republican Party Reptile, and a lot of the introductory essay basically comes from a little manifesto that Hughes and I printed in the magazine for the Pants Down Republican Party, for people who were like Republicans except drove faster and drank more.
You in your new book have a couple of put-downs of Saturday Night Live and David Letterman, so I assume that you're not happy with either of those shows that you don't
I don't actually watch Saturday Night Live. I liked Saturday Night Live when it first came out, as I think everyone did. And then it seemed to sort of lose its way, and the couple times I've checked it over the past couple years, a couple years ago it was really, really bad. And now it seems to be okay, but it's sort of like a humor variety show. I do not like David Letterman. Not as a person, I don't know him, but I do not like his show. I think there is a cruel and snobbish... The whole tone of the Letterman show seems to be there are people out in Iowa, and they're fat, and they wear pin curlers in their hair.
So you think he's condescending?
Oh, it's horrible, you know. Isn't that hilarious that those fat people wear pin curlers in their hair? Well, what does he think, that somebody, you know... when all through their teenagers, I'm working towards being a fat person living in Iowa and wearing pin curlers in my hair. Yeah. I think a lot of it is explained by the fact that David Letterman went to Ball State, certainly the college in America with the world's stupidest name.
Now who's being condescending?
I do get uncomfortable with it. I get uncomfortable with this sort of anti... And it, then, of course, when I think about it, really, it's for kids. It's for kids so they can feel hipper than their parents. My dad, you know, to make fun of people who sell storm doors for a living. You know.
I want to ask you about your work as what you called investigative humorist for Rolling Stone magazine. I think you're probably one of the few journalists who are sent on assignment to various hotspots around the globe to not only do political observation but to do humor pieces there. It's a interesting concept.
And it's a lot of fun to do because these places are very funny when you're there. The people who are there think it's funny. Everybody in the newsrooms and everybody on the news crews, the major networks, are very funny about it all in private, but it never comes out in public. The absurdity, the sort of blackness of a place like Lebanon, and the Lebanese are very amusing about this. I mean, they laugh about it all the time. But everybody takes, whenever there's a world-shattering important event, everybody gets this sort of solemn face on, and they never want to. And you can't say apartheid without everybody gets sort of hushed, you know, and it's like we're at Uncle Jaime's funeral or something. I was in South Africa over Christmas, and I was trying to figure out about trade sanctions. I've never been able to figure out whether trade sanctions were a good idea or not, and I still don't know, really. And, of course, all the white people in South Africa told me what a rotten, rotten idea they were. But surprisingly, so did a lot of black people. I'm off in the middle of Zulu land, and I'm at the world's smallest Holiday Inn. I think it's Umtata, the Umtata Holiday Inn. It looks just like a Holiday Inn anywhere, except it's teensy weensy. They're too far away to have any television, so they have a VCR, and they have TV screen in every room. They play tapes on a VCR, and the tapes they play are Zulu and Zulu Dawn, their two favorite movies. They were all in Zulu. It was shot in Zulu land, and there's, you know, you can see your cousin and your mom and everybody, and they love Zulu. Also, they get to kill all the Brits at the end, you see. And I'm talking to this kid in the bar, and he's saying, no, sanctions are a terrible idea. Now, he seemed to be very, very anti-government. He said, but sanctions are a terrible idea. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, well, we need economic power, or political power grows out of economic power. Which was a line I'd heard from the whites there. They said, oh, the blacks have to have economic power. That's the only way they'll get political power. And I said, this sounded like a very sort of sellout argument. And he said, no, we need jobs. We need to have money because that way we can buy guns. And, you know, this is not an argument I'd ever heard from the New York Times. And,
well, when you went to Lebanon, you were in Lebanon during one of the hostage takings.
Oh, yes. I was there for the TWA. I was there a year before that, and I was also right in the middle. In fact, I had dinner with the hostages before they were released. They were brought around to the Summerland Hotel. And the first thing that struck me about them was how they looked terrible. But it wasn't because they'd been maltreated that they looked terrible. They looked terrible because they looked like American tourists anywhere. I mean, they had these T-shirts on that said, I'm with stupid, and these sort of baggy loaf-around slacks with the elastic waistband, you know, and sandals with socks. And they had been thrust into a situation of enormous international importance and gravity, and frankly, they weren't dressed for it.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting observation to make in a political piece. You wrote in that same piece that you like to hang out in places where human nature is at its most baffling.
Well, it gives you something to write about. You know, I mean, Lebanon's perfect. But Lebanon's wonderful for curing you of any sort of lingering romantic collegiate ideas that you might have had about anarchy. much as I hate authority and much as I dislike power of government to be used unnecessarily, when you visit Lebanon, you get a real taste of what actual anarchy might be like.
My guest is writer P.J. O'Rourke, and I want to talk more about your humor and your journalism, but first we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Humorist P.J. O'Rourke is my guest. He's a former editor for the National Lampoon and now carries the title of investigative humorist for Rolling Stone magazine. He's written two new books, Republican Party Reptile and The Bachelor Home Companion, A Practical Guide to Keeping House Like a Pig. You seem to me to be part of what has been described as the Gonzo School of Journalism. I don't know if you'd agree with that or not, but you go into a place and you drink a lot and become a wild and crazy man, and then write a piece that's part observation and part reflection on how you fit into this environment that you put yourself into.
I try not to talk about myself. I use myself as a comic character. I'm not really too concerned about what I really think. I don't think of myself as a gonzo journalism so much. I act pretty much like any other journalist does. It's just that I tell the truth about it. Other journalists, all you get is, you get a sort of very self-important idea of what they're over there. You think they spend their entire time with kings and consorts and stuff. I know they're down there with the B-girls about two-thirds of the time, getting absolutely crocked. And I'm willing to admit that that's what journalists really do. That we cover a lot of stories from what's called Mahogany Ridge, the Battle of Mahogany Ridge.
that's the bar?
That's the bar, right?
Just making sure I get the joke. Yeah. Good, okay. So you don't think you drink more than other journalists do?
No. As a matter of fact, that's a tough league to play in. I'd say I'm kind of a fairly gifted amateur. I'm doing pretty well in the minors when it comes to drinking.
I guess I wonder, too, if the kind of persona that you have in your pieces is just that, a persona, or if it's the real you. You always seem to be drunk or hungover. And
the real me is a little more scared than the persona. Probably a little bit smarter. I think it's always, not that I'm very smart, but it's just that one plays oneself dumb. You want to make yourself the butt of the jokes. You want to make yourself the fool. It's a more polite thing to do than making somebody else the fool. And plus you're convenient, you're right at hand.
One thing you did to try to decide whether it was more boring to be smart or stupid was to watch 3 hours of TV and read the New York Review of Books for 3 hours.
Right. I did a comparison. I tried to do a scientific comparison of primetime television and the New York Review of Books.
What were you hoping to find out?
Well, which was worse, smart or stupid? Smart people aren't going to beat you up in a bar fight. On the other hand, stupid people aren't going to invent the H-bomb. But then again, smart people aren't going to drop it, or are they? I'm not sure. So I didn't really come to any earth-shaking conclusion. They're both pretty bad. I think that smart is probably just a little, smarter than stupid. But if I had to do it over again, I think I'd rather watch the primetime television. It was a lot funnier. The main thing I realized is that if you watch primetime television, you have to bring all your intelligence to bear upon it to get anything out of it. Whereas if you read the New York Review of Books and its ilk, you have to shine the cold, hard light of stupidity upon them if you want to get anything out of them.
A few years ago, you moved from Manhattan to New Hampshire, which is a pretty drastic departure to go from the middle of the city to the country. Why did you want to get away from New York?
Well, it wasn't so much a matter of getting... I'd never wanted to be in New York. I had to be in New York professionally to be a magazine editor and at first to be a magazine writer. I've always hated New York. I think it's a loathsome city. I honestly like Beirut better. I would rather go this evening to Beirut, East Beirut at any rate, than I would to New York. It's easier to get a cab in Beirut. The people are more polite, and the restaurants are a lot cheaper. So are the apartments. They might have a large shell hole in the side of them, but that's nothing compared to what some apartments in New York have. I can't believe that we, the richest country, or if we still are, the richest country for our size in the world, can have what amounts to, in all senses except the strictly political, our capital look and smell like New York does. I just find it absolutely shocking.
Did you want to get away from Bohemia also?
Yeah, I think there was a certain element to that. There is about Bohemia is fun when you're young, but there is about Bohemia the enduring stink of failure. Not that all Bohemians are failures or all failures are Bohemians, but there is a strong element in the Bohemian subculture of people who not only haven't made it and not only aren't ever going to make it, but never, ever deserved to make it. People who are bright, talented, and exceedingly self-limited. And I lived for many years in a village in New York, and one more drunk poet bemoaning his fate. I guess it's not poets anymore. Now it's one more coked-up performance artist bemoaning his or her fate. But in my day, it was one more drunk poet bemoaning his fate. Was really more than I could bear. Yeah.
You described the town that you're living in as trying to be cute.
Yes. Yeah, there are three types of New England towns. There are towns that are towns that know they're cute, towns that don't know they're cute, and towns that are trying hard as all get out to become cute. And I live in the third kind. The first kind is the kind with the everything's painted white with green shutters, and there are a lot of Volvos with Save the Whales. You love these in Vermont. Then there are the towns that don't know they're cute, or the ones with where apparently there's a zoning regulation where you have to have trailers in the front yard. And cars up on blocks, and where the 1690 weather vane on top of the meeting house is regularly used as target practice by the little kids with 22s, and instead of doing what we more civilized people would like to do is just turn it into a lamp. I live in a kind of middling town, the town that's just beginning to get the glimmer of the idea that it's pretty cute, and they're working real hard on getting some, getting the Shell station to spell it with an extra E on the end, get everything.
This is the kind of place where you're going to be an outsider for the rest of your life because you weren't born there?
No. That used to be the case with New England is that, in fact, there is a little bit of that. No one, of course, calls my place by my name. It's not the O'Rourke place. It's the Yateman place. And the Yatemans haven't been in Jaffrey, New Hampshire in, 50 years, I think, since the last Yateman cleared out of Jaffrey. But you see, there's been such an influx of people from Massachusetts and people from Boston, High Tech Alley outside Boston, that a regular Ohio boy like me who hunts and fishes and has a pickup truck and actually knows how to run it into the woods when he's had one too many beers, I'm pretty well accepted, I think. I suppose I'll never be a native, but then hardly anyone there is a native, so.
Humorist P.J. O'Rourke is my guest. Well, here you are living in New England and apparently still being as much the slob as
yes,
ever.
Yes, yeah. it's a cleaner, simply because the place is cleaner. In New York, all you have to do to be a slob is open your window once a week.
Well, when I found out that you'd written The Bachelor Home Companion, which is a practical guide to keeping house like a pig, I thought, well, swell, we could sit around and swap anecdotes about how messy and, our houses are. And then I read the dedication in your book, and you dedicated to Alma, who's
my cleaning lady,
who's kept house for you for 10 years. And
yeah.
I thought, well, you're cheating.
How
can you call yourself genuinely sloppy if you've really got someone in cleaning house?
Well,
for
she
you.
Only comes. She did. I don't have a place in New York anymore. But she only came once a week. So there were another 6 days. And by day six, things were pretty disastrous. But I used to go out with a wonderful, wonderful girl. And who was simply the worst slob I have ever seen in my life. Not in her personal appearance, but in the way she behaved. She once fixed herself a little omelet on my stove, and just unthinkingly, she was eating it out of the iron skillet. And she just set the hot iron skillet down on my desk. Not that it was a valuable antique or anything like that, but just right through the varnish. It was such a marvelously casual act. And she would walk out the door with like a dish of ice cream and, my dish and my spoon, and then off she'd go down the elevator. And whenever she unburdened herself of anything, clothing or purse or wherever it fell, that's where it stayed. But her apartment always looked fabulous, and there was food in the refrigerator, and everything was completely pulled together. And I couldn't get these two. And finally I said, wait, who comes in? Who does this? And she had this fabulous woman from Barbados, Alma, and who I got to work for me, and who at least one day out of seven would turn my apartment into a little showplace of cleanliness, at any rate, if not appearance.
Does it ever feel awkward having someone come in to clean house?
Not Alma, no. No, she's wonderful. She would bawl me out for smoking too much and feeling not eating right and things. But no, she was not an intrusive person.
Since we're on the air, I should ask you for the most embarrassing, best place to get people to admit to things, the most embarrassing thing you do as a housekeeper.
Most embarrassing thing that I do? I don't know. I think you'd have to take me back in time. You know, the thing is, you get older, I have a fear that I'm turning into, I'm almost 40 now, that I'm starting to turn into one of those fussy bachelor types, place for everything and everything in its place. Of course, that place happens to be the floor, but I once lived in a loft in Baltimore, not a loft, it was a filthy industrial building. It was so dirty that the only clean place in the house was the vegetable crispers. I was far too young to eat vegetables. The vegetable crisper in the refrigerator, and that's where I had to keep my shirts in order to present a halfway decent appearance whenever I was hauled into police court or whatever. The only place in the house where you could keep a white shirt where it wouldn't get absolutely filthy was in the vegetable crisper. I don't know how embarrassing that is, but
I think there's maybe something genetic as far as the ability to keep order. But
I actually come from a fairly my really? Mom was not a great housekeeper, and dads in those days, of course, didn't keep house. So,
you know, you have tips on the handling of mothers and fathers of children in your book, and you describe how you actually identify more with the children than with the parents. And as you pointed out, you're nearing 40. It must be pretty awkward sometimes. You don't understand parents, right?
I don't understand parents. Well, I'm not. It's funny. I have a lot of. I'm not tremendously fond of children, but I understand what goes on in their mind. I can't say I exactly like them, but I know them. You know, I think staying single keeps you, in some sense, a child. And you know, I know what's going on in their little minds. And a child, of course, always makes sense. A child is simply selfishness personified. You know, what the child wants, the child wants. You know, but adults do confuse me. I had an awful experience a few years back. Just you know, not personal experience, but just. Sort of awful thing I observed. There was this little girl, about 3 years old, and she kept. I was in a deli. I was waiting to be waited on in a deli, and the girl's mother was there at the counter, and the little girl was looking around, and she took this Twinkie off the rack, and she walked up and she put it beside her mother's groceries at the counter, and her mother said, "Take that back. We don't eat those things in our house. Twinkie, take that back." Shamefaced kid took it and put it back where it came from. And then I saw her sitting there thinking, you know, she didn't know what to do. She wanted the Twinkie, and she couldn't figure out. She said, "Well, we'll just give it another try." You know, so she picks it up again from the rack and walks over and does the same thing, puts it back on the counter. And her mother really turned on her and said, "That's not food." And this awful look came over the kid's face. It wasn't that she didn't get the Twinkie so much. It was the first time she'd ever seen her mother lie. First time she... Look, that Twinkie may not be good for you. It may not be good food, but it is food. The kid knew it was food. She'd had one somewhere, you know, at day school or at a friend's house or something. The Twinkie was food. Her mom was lying to her. You know? That's not food.
We're just about out of time, but I wonder if you ever get concerned that the crazy young humorist might turn into the middle-aged curmudgeon.
Yeah, the crazy middle. Yeah, crazy young people are sort of attracted to something wonderful, sort of poetic about crazy young people. Crazy middle-aged people are the ones with bags on the street.
So,
yeah, I worry about it all the time. I don't know, but so I have the same response as I usually do to anything that worries me. I have a big cocktail.
Right. Okay. P.J. O'Rourke, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Thanks for being here. Humorist P.J. O'Rourke has been my guest. He's a former editor of the National Lampoon and now goes by the title of investigative humorist for Rolling Stone magazine. He's just had two books published, The Bachelor Home Companion, A Practical Guide to Keeping House Like a Pig, published by Pocket Books, and Republican Party Reptile, published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with jazz composer and drummer Max Roach, so I hope you can join us. This is Max Roach playing with Charlie Parker. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, movie production designer Patricia von Brandenstein talks about how she made Chicago look nearly 50 years younger for the movie The Untouchables. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings of music by Stravinsky and Bartok, both conducted by Pierre Boulez. A revival of George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion leads our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg to discuss social class and proper diction. And we'll have a news update from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the news. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review of two new compact discs that feature the French conductor Pierre Boulez. Throughout his career, Boulez has embraced and promoted the modern repertoire, sometimes to the dismay of more romantically inclined audiences. On these recordings, he conducts Bartok and Stravinsky.
As conductor, composer, and writer, Pierre Boulez has developed a forbidding reputation for technical precision, intellectual incisiveness, and emotional detachment. He appeared once on The Tonight Show and demonstrated his perfect pitch by correctly identifying any note played at random. A cool character. How could any other kind be interested in the cold abstractions of 20th century music? I think people who believe this have never heard or at least never listened to a Boulez performance. Of course, the textures are always prismatically, scientifically clear. On a Boulez recording, you can hear everything. And if you've ever heard him conduct in person, you know it's not just the recording engineers who are doing the clarifying. What isn't there are the excesses, the exhibitionism, the melodramatic revving up you hear from so many conductors who think you have to be heavy to be deep. Boulez doesn't need to inflate because he's right there with the composer, carefully observing, following, and empathizing with every nuance of a score. Technically, this comes out in the process of balancing, the kind of analytic approach that makes sure no instrument is drowning out or blending too much with another, and in the process of phrasing, which is a more subtle matter of rhythmic continuity. In a Boulez performance, you don't just hear notes, but urgent, unstoppable waves of music. Naturally, this approach is especially useful for new music, or music we don't get to hear very often. But a Boulez performance of a work like the Beethoven Fifth Symphony will also sound like something you're hearing for the first time. From large-scale Mahler and Wagner to delicate Mozart serenades and early Schubert symphonies, which he's never recorded, his versions are among the most moving, affectionate, and unpretentious I've ever heard. Last week, I talked about his new Schoenberg record on RCA. But I'd also like to call your attention to two new CBS Masterworks compact discs that include several of his greatest recordings from the 70s. One has his exuberantly colorful and touching performance of Stravinsky's Petrushka with the New York Philharmonic when it was still a great ensemble. The late Paul Jacobs is at the piano. And an overwhelming Rite of Spring with the Cleveland Orchestra, which still is a great ensemble. The other has Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, also with the Philharmonic, and his music for strings, percussion, and celesta with the BBC Symphony. The Stravinskys are the most vivid recordings of these masterpieces after Stravinsky's own, and technically even more authoritative. The Bartoks are on a completely different level from any other performances I've heard, sweeping, yet delicate, and totally mesmerizing.
Thank you.
That was part of the interrupted intermezzo from Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, conducted by Pierre Boulez. The interruption was that jaunty little clarinet theme from The Merry Widow. Shostakovich quoted it in his Leningrad Symphony, which Bartók heard on the radio, couldn't stand, and immediately had to use. The CDs are in splendid sound, and of course provide the advantage of not having to interrupt the music by turning the record over. With both Stravinsky's and both Bartók's paired on single discs, they're also phenomenal bargains.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Patrizia von Brandenstein, who began her career painting sets for the New York stage. She's now an Academy Award-winning movie production designer. Her credits include Amadeus, Ragtime, A Chorus Line, Breaking Away, Saturday Night Fever, and The Untouchables. A production designer chooses locations and dresses the set, but von Brandenstein has become known in her field for her attention to detail and the overall interpretation that she brings to a film. She's currently working in Canada on a new film for Costa Gavras. We caught up with her as she was about to teach a production workshop at Robert Redford's Sundance Institute in Salt Lake City. I asked her to tell me about the design challenges presented to her by Brian De Palma, director of The Untouchables.
He felt that The Untouchables, this time, that is the gangster era of Chicago, had been explored many, many times in television plays and movies and all sorts of presentations. So they had grown up a kind of cliche about Prohibition, the 30s, gangsters, etc., and that he wanted to take these characters to myth, an American myth, good and bad, good and evil. He wanted to make Capone a titan. He wanted him to have a kind of absolute power, so that the city of Chicago is in the grip of this absolute power, so that the untouchables would seem all the more unlikely and helpless and vulnerable.
If De Palma wanted the film to have a mythic quality, what kinds of symbols did you look for that you could put into the movie that would help transfer that sense of being larger than life?
Well, most specifically, there are emblems in particularly in Capone's digs that are mythic, specifically the Sun King, a world where the world of Chicago revolving around Capone, and there are themes and symbols of the sun that are worked architecturally into those sets. But those are things that we built. Now in Chicago, we were looking for mass. We were looking for power. We were looking for the idea of urban strength, of a city that rises directly out of the plain, out of the prairie, with this enormous mass of stone, and it denotes power.
Some of the architecture that you used is the municipal architecture downtown. There's the courthouse. You have the train station.
Yes.
Is it hard to get buildings like that existed during Capone's time and still exist now to look
as if it
was then and not now? There must be a lot of little things that you have to get rid of so it doesn't betray the fact that you're shooting this in the 1980s.
Of course, and a lot of little things and a lot of big things. It's very hard to do this without, in fact, impossible to do this without municipal cooperation. In the case of the city of Chicago, they are absolutely behind trying to bring film business to Chicago because it's a very good source of income. One of the hardest things to do was to get the cultural center. The Chicago Cultural Center is on the National Historic Register. It's a national landmark. It's a great and grand building, and we used it more or less constantly for 3 weeks with men jumping off buildings and shootouts and what have you. We used it for the exterior of the courtroom, for the shootout on the stairs, the shootout on the roof. We used one entrance, which would be the south entrance, for the entrance to the opera, and it works very well.
I have this theory that you can frequently tell what decade a movie was in by looking at the hairdos. And I mean movies that are set several centuries ago, especially biblical epics. I can always tell when a biblical epic was made by looking at the hairdos, because even though they try to really evoke the past, sometimes, you know, like the queen has a flip, you know, or a chignon, and you just know when the movie was made. Are there details like that for you that always betray when a movie was made, even though it's trying to look true to its time?
Not the ones I've done. I think that that was true for about for a couple of decades, so the 40s and 50s. But honestly, I think the design of films and costumes and hair has made some progress, and that we do set a much higher premium now on authenticity and on accuracy, and certainly actors who are prominent now are very interested in being as accurate as possible. I know that all of the Untouchables and Mr. Connery and Mr. De Niro were extremely interested in being as accurate to a historical persona. Not that every event really happened or every single thing is true about the film, but they are true to the time. They're true to the era.
I have to ask you one thing about Amadeus, which you did the production design for. I'd never seen wigs quite like that. I don't know if you worked on the wigs or not.
Yes.
They seemed higher to me and more must and anarchic in a way than I've ever seen powdered wigs look before.
Well, the convention that you see, of course, is one style of wig with two rolls on the side and only using a white powder. We checked accuracy to a tremendous degree, and we discovered that there were many, many different kinds of wigs, that they were made of many different kinds of things according to the status of the wearer. Wigs were universal, but can you imagine a wig made of horse hair? Can you imagine a wig made of cotton string? A wig made of furs of various kinds, and yet those were all valid too.
Has life ever copied your art? Have you ever set trends because of things you've designed for movies?
I would say that the costumes in Saturday Night Fever had a certain influence on disco wear for a while.
How did you get all the costumes to stay put while everybody was dancing? Usually you get so sloppy when you dance. Your shirt comes out of your pants and your jacket flies out.
There's all manner of tricks. Those costumes, they're made like dance costumes, the same way a ballet or a jazz dancer. It's a costume. It's not clothes. What happened was we wanted an extremely mass-produced polyester look for all of those clothes. So the men's suits were purchased and then taken apart so that they would, and put back together again so that they would fit beautifully.
You sometimes have to go to an enormous amount of detail work for a scene that will be on screen for just a few seconds or maybe a minute. Is that ever frustrating?
Well, I think it's far more frustrating to a production designer or a costume designer. I think it's far more frustrating to not be able to do the details properly. I think whatever difficulties you have to go through to get it right, I don't think anybody minds that. I think what you mind is not having the opportunity to get it right because there's no time or there's no money and what have you. And I think that's really a terrible thing for a designer to go through.
From a production design perspective, what makes a great script? What do you look for in a script before deciding to do a movie?
I look for a good script. I don't feel that I serve my career or my obligations to my career, to myself, well by choosing something that is only a series of pretty pictures or a series of difficult designs to execute. What I look for is a good script, a good story. The same things that directors and producers look for. How can you say, why does someone like a picture? Why does someone like a book? But whatever that is, that's what you aspire to in motion pictures as well. And that's the kind of script I look for.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Patricia von Brandenstein was the production designer for the new film The Untouchables. She won an Academy Award for her work on the movie Amadeus. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you covering today?
We're following political developments in South Korea, also a ruling by the Supreme Court on free speech, and a report on Jesse Jackson in Iowa, where it seems that he won the hearts, but not the votes, of some Iowa farmers.
What else is new?
What else is new? Well, an easy cleaning bird cage, a rubber band holder, a piglet catcher. How does that strike you?
Oh, what's this?
These are children's inventions, and their inventors will be with us this evening.
You're speaking to the children who invented these things?
Exactly.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you've ever seen the movie or the play My Fair Lady, you may remember this exchange between Professor Higgins and Eliza Doolittle.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
Higgins is trying to teach the Cockney flower girl how to speak like a proper lady. My Fair Lady is based on George Bernard Shaw's play, Pygmalion. Peter O'Toole and Amanda Plummer are currently starring on Broadway in a production of Pygmalion. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, went to see it, and he has these thoughts on Shaw's premise for the play and O'Toole's interpretation of it.
George Bernard Shaw liked to boast about the success that Pygmalion enjoyed, both on stage and on the screen, because it was, in his words, so intensely and deliberately didactic a play. For him, the play had a serious message. As he put it, if it makes the public aware that there are such people as phoneticians, and that they are among the most important people in England at present, it will serve its turn. And he closed the preface to the play with earnest advice to working-class speakers as to how to find a phonetician to improve their own accents. Shaw took the issue so seriously, in fact, that he left the bulk of his estate to be used to promulgate a phonetic spelling system for English. That way, if you knew how to spell a word, you'd know how to pronounce it correctly, and thus the English would finally be able to teach their children how to speak. It might have disconcerted Shaw to see the production of Pygmalion now playing on Broadway with Peter O'Toole as Higgins. In fact, the production has been unnerving to a lot of people whose conception of Higgins was shaped by the urbane portrayals of Leslie Howard or Rex Harrison. O'Toole treats the play as a broad farce, lurching into furniture, diving through windows, and delivering Higgins' lines in the high histrionic style he used in films like The Ruling Class and My Favorite Year, which makes Higgins often harder to comprehend than the Cockney Eliza. This Higgins is no mere eccentric, he's a full-fledged lunatic. But then, how else should a character like Higgins be portrayed? Consider, Higgins is a man confronting the facts of class snobbery. The poor are deprecated for their speech and manners. What does he propose we should do? Why, teach the poor to talk like gentlemen and ladies. Then they will no longer be despised. Now, this is clearly crazy. In fact, Higgins' madness is characteristically Shavian. It's what happens to a relentlessly logical man when he tries to come to grips with a relentlessly irrational society. Shaw's got it all backwards. Class snobbery doesn't exist because of differences in speech. It only feeds on them. To paraphrase Plato, we do not esteem people because they speak well. They speak well because we esteem them. A dropped R is classy in the mouth of an educated Englishman and boorish in the mouth of a Brooklynite, but the sound is the same in either case. To see how crazy this is, try importing the view into the modern racial context. You would wind up concluding that racial differences could be eliminated if only blacks would learn to use hair straightener. But the madness of the view isn't evident in earlier versions of Pygmalion, because they have treated the story as a kind of fairy tale, with Eliza as a drawing room Cinderella and Higgins as a combination of fairy godmother and Prince Charming. Yet this is clearly not what Shaw had in mind. For one thing, Shaw was insistent that Eliza does not return to Higgins at the end, which is the fairy tale ending that all versions before O'Toole's have provided. So let's at least give O'Toole credit for taking Shaw's didactic intentions at face value, even if the result is to turn the play from a fairy tale to a farce.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University.
With the speed of summer lightning, and the Hebrews learn it backwards, which is absolutely frightening. But use proper English, you're regarded as a freak. Oh, why can't the English? Why can't the English learn to speak?
Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, I'll speak with character actor Robert Loggia. He was the cocaine kingpin in Scarface, the private investigator in Jagged Edge, and the New York cop in the new film The Believers. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Tango in the Night, the first Fleetwood Mac album in 5 years. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Roxanne, the new Steve Martin comedy based on Cyrano de Bergerac. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance today from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vablitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.